From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, astrologer Mark Lerner joins us and your readings. Here's what's happening. North Korea began this year with a record-breaking spate of missile launches, but stopped short of a truly provocative step. That's ending its self-imposed moratorium on nukes and intercontinental ballistic missile tests. Some experts say that next move could be just a matter of time. Kim Jong-un, the country's leader, has already threatened to end the moratorium, saying at a party meeting in January that his country would consider restarting all temporarily suspended activities and switching to more powerful physical means to deter the United States. In a report just published, a team of analysts at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies said they had located an underground regiment-sized military base used for housing North Korean ICBMs just 15 miles from the border with China. We'll keep our eyes on that. French President Emmanuel Macron has told reporters that President Vladimir Putin has assured him that Russian forces would not ramp up the crisis near Ukraine's border. However, Russia says any suggestion of a guarantee was not correct. Russia has denied any plans to invade Ukraine, but it has assembled more than 100,000 troops near its borders. U.S. officials believe Russia has assembled 70% of military forces needed for a full-scale invasion. Larry Connors has been broadcasting for decades. He's got his own talk show in St. Louis, Larry Connors USA. That's also his website, and he's with us on the line right now. He's an expert on these matters. Larry, is this blind man's bluff, or is something going to happen out there?
George, I think probably the best declaration is KP McFarland, who had been a previous deputy and national security director for Trump, said that Russia has all of its chips in. And it's 8 o'clock in the morning, Wednesday morning, and we still have 100,000 troops gathered all around Ukraine, as you pointed out. Six ships at least going into the Baltic Sea from Russia, be south of Ukraine. Moscow claims this is all military drills. They announced it a month ago. But as you said, Putin says, there's no significant change here, and unless there is, well, we'll see who's bluffing, who's playing.
And it's a dangerous bluff to be sure, Larry. Thank you. Though considered milder than any other coronavirus variants, Omicron has infected so many people that it has driven the number of daily deaths beyond where it was last spring. Omicron has particularly lethal to people over 75, the medically vulnerable, according to doctors and public health officials. The soaring death toll also illustrates why experts pleaded with the public to be aware of the highly contagious variant, even though it is less virulent than others. Pfizer is projecting it will generate a record high volume of 22 in this year, saying it expects to sell $32 billion of its COVID-19 shots and $22 billion of its antiviral coronavirus treatment pill this year alone. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com with us. John, this is unbelievable money there.
Well, of course, you know, Pfizer doesn't do this because, you know, they're just altruistic. They're a publicly multinational corporation, one of the richest in the world. But that's not what's really happening right now. So I think for the public to understand this, I think without being overly, you know, optimistic about this, we've seen the first cracks in this Omicron virus. The surge has begun to slow. And the reason it's slowing, which is the most important reason, is because the BA1 Omicron, which is the first of the Omicron viruses, is now, the researchers at World Health Organization and the CDC are believing that people who have been infected or have antibodies for BA1 Omicron will not get the BA2 Omicron, which means together with the 75% or 211 million people in the United States that have already had two vaccines, that's 65%, it means that the immunity environment has gone up, which means that the BA2 variant is not moving through the U.S. population. There's only 460 cases, and this has been around for several weeks now. That means, George, that like the H1N1 of 1918, it took about 3 years before the attenuation of the overall pandemic. I think we're beginning to see, unless some new variant, and I'm not talking about the Omicron, the BA1, the BA2, or the BA3, if there's no new variant that comes in, it looks like we're moving in a direction that 53% down in hospitalizations, and even though there's a lingering death toll right now, and depending on who you're asking, in the United States, it looks like it's in the neighborhood of 930,000 right now. So we could get a million deaths from this virus. But I think we're beginning to see the first signs reported by the CDC and WHO that the BA2 variant and the BA3 are being neutralized by the BA1, which means we may be near the end of this pandemic in another 3 to 6 months.
Well, we need that, maybe even quicker. Thank you. Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Up next, Dr. John Abramson joins us as we talk about his latest work, Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. We're going to be talking about how much money they're making and what's going on next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. John Abramson back with us, has worked as a family doctor in Appalachia and in Hamilton, Massachusetts, has served as a chairperson of the Department of Family Practice at the Leahy Clinic. He was a Robert Wood Johnson Fellow, currently a clinical faculty member at Harvard Medical School. He teaches primary care. His book that he talked with me about a long time ago, Overdosed America, The Broken Promises of American Medicine. John, has it been 10 years since you last have been on? Are you there, John? Nope, he's not there. Right out of the box, folks. He disappeared on us. So we'll get him back. And maybe it's been longer than 10 years since we got him back on. What we're going to talk with Dr. John Abramson about is, of course, his views on Big Pharma and how much they are making these days with everything. You heard the story about Pfizer making billions of dollars on the incredible situation that they're doing with the COVID vaccine. And we'll check in with them. You got him back yet, Tom? Okay, we're still working on trying to get him back. If not, maybe we can get Mark Lerner back on if you want to, John. And Tommy, let's get Mark Lerner back on. Something's drastically wrong with Dr. John Abramson. It seems like, folks, I got to apologize for something, that we always get into something very controversial, and the guest just disappears. He just is absolutely gone. But we've got an option. We can do some open lines for you if we want. But I'm going to go to a little tape in just a second. We don't have a tape? Okay. So, Tommy, come back on for a minute. You and I are going to chit-chat for a little bit. Put your headsets on, and we're going to get this straightened out right now.
Well,
a little too controversial? What happened to him?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it happens all the time. He's just gone. And then when I call back, it goes to nowhere. It's very strange.
Well, what we'll probably
That's
end
him.
Up doing.
You can hear that right now? That's him calling my cell phone right now. So
all right,
I need just a minute here.
Grab it and get it back on. See what you can do. The wonders of live radio, folks. But we'll get it straightened out and we'll get back. His interview is so important. I really don't want to lose him. It's an amazing story about just what is happening in the world. And I've got to point this out, too. I am not opposed to vaccines by any means. I think in some cases vaccines are fantastic. What I'm opposed to is mandating, telling people what to do. Okay, Tom says we've got Dr. John, you're back with us.
I'm back. I'm sorry. My internet went down.
Oh, my God. You sure they didn't clip you on purpose?
I am not. It's the second time it's happened today. It's at a crucial moment.
Strange things, because we've been publicizing your appearance on the program. And my question to you before you disappeared was, has it been 10 years since you were last on with me?
I think so. And I think it's been 18 years since I was first on with you.
Yeah, it's been a long time, indeed. Well, I'm glad we got you back on, and let's keep our fingers crossed that it's going to hold for the rest of the night. And we were talking about your new work called Sickening, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. We were talking earlier in my news segment, John, about Pfizer reporting that they have made billions of dollars just on COVID. My God, what's going on?
They've made, before the COVID vaccines came along, the best-selling drug in the world was selling $20 billion a year, Humira. And the Pfizer vaccine sold, I think, $36.8 billion the first year, and it's going to sell $32 billion the next year. And their profit margin, which they said was in the high 20s early on when they were still paying for their development, is going to go up to 60 to 80%.
60 to 80%?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of makes you wonder about COVID-19, doesn't it?
Well, it makes you wonder about the fundamental purpose of the drug companies being to make money. And regardless of what the situation is, they're going to do their best to make the most money they can.
Well, number one, as a corporation, can you blame them for wanting to make a profit?
You can't, George. I totally agree with that. And I believe in markets. I don't think we should socialize the drug industry or anything radical like that. But I do think that the drug companies, when they get patents, they have monopolies. And they have monopolies on what are public utilities. Some of these drugs work. The COVID vaccine works. Three-quarters of them aren't better than previous drugs, but a quarter of them work, and they're superior. But they shouldn't be able to take that monopoly and extort money from working people because there's no price controls. If you're going to get a monopoly and you're going to be able to sell your drug without competition, somebody's got to protect the American people from price gouging.
Now, in terms of the vaccine itself, didn't it come out way too soon? These three companies that came out with them, Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, didn't they come out way too fast?
It's a good question. There's a gray zone from too soon to too slow. The COVID pandemic was a disaster. It was clear that hundreds of thousands of people were going to die. And at some point, part of being trained as a physician is you've got to learn that you'll be in situations where you must make a decision without adequate information. You have to make a decision. And I think that's where we were. I think good people can disagree about whether it was too soon. But in fact, as we see how this unfolded, the drug companies and the scientists really kind of got it right. I'm not a fan of the drug companies. You won't find a bigger critic of the drug companies, and I know more about this, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about what I learned in the 10 years I spent inside drug company computers as an expert in litigation. But what happened was the pandemic was coming on, and President Trump, to his credit, created Operation Warp Speed, which just threw money at the drug companies to create a vaccine. We were spending five times more per person than the European Union was initially. And Americans did have access to the vaccine earlier than the Europeans did. I think in retrospect, that probably played out fairly well. What we didn't do is while we were throwing money at this and making sure that the drug companies had more incentive than they needed to go ahead and work full steam ahead, what we didn't do is we didn't make sure that the drug companies would do a reasonable job of vaccinating the poorer countries. So now we have a situation where the drug companies are making top dollar as much as they can, like you just said about Pfizer, selling their drugs to the first world. Well, we leave the third world unvaccinated. Africa has about a 10% vaccination rate, and it's a breeding ground for further variations of the virus. So the expert you had who was talking about the news and in the news and gave a optimistic view of where we're going, where we're headed post Omicron. It's kind of from his lips to God's ears. I hope it works out that way. But we've got so much of the third world that has such a low vaccination rate that we are highly at risk of more of these dangerous variants coming along, evading the immunity that we have either from prior infection or vaccination, and going through more cycles of this.
John, how do these viruses know how to mutate to fight a vaccine, for example?
Yeah, great question, George. So, they don't know. It's not like they're intelligent. And they say if we change our spike, the spikes on the outside that the immune system sees, if we change our spikes like this, we'll evade Pfizer's or Moderna's right. or Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. What they do is they mutate spontaneously in genetic errors. You get different kinds of changes. And the changes that create greater infectivity then thrive. So, for example, we've got the BA1 variant of Omicron now, and it's peaked. The death toll hasn't yet come down, but it's plateaued at around 2,500 American deaths a day. And it looks like we're on the downslope from Omicron BA1. But now we've got BA2. It's over, it's in 57 countries now. It's taken over in Denmark. And it's more infectious. So it's not like the virus is intelligent and figured it out. It's that through random changes, some of the changes make the new variant more infectious, and then that takes over in the population and becomes the predominant species. So that's how you know the relative infectivity of the new variant. It's how quickly it's taking over to replace the previously dominant strain of COVID.
John, I keep seeing studies where it says, you know, load up on vitamin D3, zinc, turmeric, vitamin C to build up your immune system. That's what I've been doing for 2 years. It seems to be working with me and a lot of other people. Why aren't more and more people being told this?
The science may not be at the level that doctors are trained to require to make a professional recommendation. But that said, I don't want to waste one bit of anyone's time arguing whether they should take the regimen that you're taking of healthy, natural foods and vitamins to keep your immune system up. If you think they're going to help, do it. Do it. And also, please get vaccinated, because you have 20 times the risk of death from COVID now, even now, if you're unvaccinated than if you're vaccinated. So I think that a lot of the discussion about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine mm-hmm. and the natural vitamin D and the other natural approaches, I think if you feel it's going to help you, do it. By all means, do it. You'd be crazy not to do it. But also use the conventional, the vaccination as well.
You're not an anti-vax guy. You never have been, have you?
No. No, I was somewhat dubious as a practicing doc when the chickenpox vaccine came in. I was somewhat dubious. Chickenpox was not a major problem. It was a little bit of a social problem. Moms were missing work.
Is that what creates shingles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. And you can get rid of shingles. That's one of the biggest arguments for getting the chickenpox vaccine. But in any event, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, and I'm not a rabid pro-vaxxer, and I am certainly a critic of the drug companies. And if you want to know about what's wrong with them, I'm the guy to talk to. But in this case, it's clear from real-world data, not necessarily from the drug companies' data, because they're not being quite as forthright as they could be, but from the real-world data that's out there with the millions of doses, tens of millions of doses, hundreds of millions of doses that have been given in the United States, we can see what's actually happening in people who are vaccinated compared to people who aren't vaccinated. And that data, more than the drug company's data, shows us how important the vaccinations are.
John, we're going to take a quick break and come back. Dr. John Abramson with us. His internet phone went down, folks, but we've got his cell now as a backup, so things should go well. We're going to take calls with him next hour here on Coast to Coast, so get ready for that. But we're talking about Sickening. That's the name of his book, How Big Pharma Broke American Healthcare and How We Can Repair It. So there is some hope there. We'll be back in a moment with more with Dr. John Abramson right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. John Abramson with us. John, what would you be your biggest gripe be about Big Pharma?
My biggest gripe is that their job is to maximize the profits they earn and give those profits to their investors. That's their primary function, is to maximize the amount of money that they turn over to their investors.
At any cost, right?
At any cost and collateral damage, as long as it doesn't compromise their future earnings. And the cost is not great enough for the illegal activities that they engage in. But there's to maximize those profits, what they do is they've taken control of medical knowledge. So they fund the research. They determine what the research will be about, which is about expensive new drugs and devices, not about making Americans healthier. They control the data. They own the data. When they finish a study and they write it up and they submit it to a medical journal, even the most prestigious medical journals in the world, they don't submit the underlying data along with the manuscript to the journal. So the peer reviewers who are supposed to vet the data, vet the articles so that doctors know what they're reading is real science, the peer reviewers don't get to see the data. The people who write the clinical practice guidelines that set the standards for doctors don't get to see the data. And they can charge as much as they want. They and when they get caught, they pay a penalty. They've paid $38 billion in fines between 1991 and 2017. But that's just the mere cost of doing business. It's not a big amount of money to them. So they go along their way taking more money than they deserve from working Americans and delivering it to investors. And along the way, they create the illusion that we're providing the best health care in the world in the United States, and our health care is so far from the best. We rank 68th in the world in healthy life expectancy. We're behind China and Cuba in healthy life expectancy.
Jeez, that's crazy.
It's crazy. And for this, we've gone down from 38th in 2000 to 68th in 2017. And for this plummet in the health of Americans compared to the citizens of other countries, we're spending an extra $1.5 trillion a year. We spend 7% more of our GDP than the average of the other wealthy countries. That translates into $1.5 trillion a year that we're spending on this health care that's leading our health to down the tubes.
Let me get a conspiratorial for just a moment. How do we know Big Pharma isn't behind or responsible for COVID-19? How do we know that they didn't help this laboratory in Wuhan develop this thing quietly,
and then it comes out?
That's a fair question.
That's a fair question, George, because if you were an evil genius and your only goal were to create the maximum profits and you knew you weren't going to get caught, this is exactly what you would have done.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that they're purposely evil. I think they go about their business using journeyman tactics, whether it's a minor drug or whether it's OxyContin. They use their journeyman tactics to brand their drugs, to influence the minds of doctors.
But they love disease. You got to admit that, John. They must love disease.
Absolutely. They love disease, and they hate the kinds of studies that would show that living a healthy lifestyle and getting good exercise and not smoking and eating a healthy diet, they hate those studies.
And supplementation.
Sure.
They can't stand that.
Yeah, no question about it. I'm with you all the way. I think there are limits. If they got caught, I got into a situation with my last book where my phone went down three times in a row on a public radio interview.
Yeah, I'm telling you, somebody's playing around with your phone.
Yeah. But I called my friends at the FBI. I've worked with the FBI They're good guys. And I called them and I said, can you guys track this down? Because this isn't right. And they were of the opinion that the drug companies wouldn't do it, that there are limits to their malfeasance. Now, I kind of disagree. I'm not sure that they wouldn't knock a phone out to avoid an embarrassing interview like we might be doing now. But I think there are limits.
Why in God's name? Because I believe that this virus was created in that laboratory in Wuhan, China. Whether we helped finance it or not is debatable. We might have done that. But why in God's name would they create this in a laboratory? Was it a bioweapon that got loose by mistake?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't say that it wasn't created in the laboratory. I think there's probably an equal probability that that it was a natural phenomenon that it crossed over from an animal species. But it's not.
You wouldn't rule it out, though. You wouldn't rule out a lab creation.
No, you can't rule it out. And even I think that if you were a researcher and you were trying to predict where the next pandemic came from, and you were tinkering with viruses to see how they might mutate, like we talked about before, that the mutations are random, they're not intelligent, but they prosper based on their the genetic fit with what it takes to spread. You might want to tinker with a virus to see where it could evolve to so that you could be ready to deal with it. It's conceivable. I'm not an expert in this stuff, but it's conceivable that kind of activity was going on and that there was a leak, a mistake.
There are two things that I just don't understand, John, and let me tell you what they are. One, the Big Bang Theory about the universe, I don't get it, and I haven't had a guest on in 20 years who's been able to explain to me how things started from nothing. I just don't get it. The second thing was, I'm told countlessly by virologists on this program that viruses are not alive. So if they're not alive, how do they function? I don't get it.
Yeah, I think I can help you with this. Think of a computer virus. A computer virus isn't alive, but it can get into the guts of your computer with code, and it can take over the code of your computer and make it malfunction. This is it's exactly analogous, but it's with our genes. The virus is not alive, but it's a packet of genetic material. On the outside, it's got the spike proteins, which help it to attach to cells and invade cells. And that's what our immune system recognizes, so we don't get reinfected. That's on the outside. On the inside, it's genetic material. And what it does is it gets inside cells, and it takes over the genetic mechanism within the cell. So without being alive, it can reproduce its genetic material and then repackage the genetic material. And the cell, the infected cell, extrudes the viral particles that have grown inside the cell.
If you were at the big pharma right now coming out with these vaccines that are making billions of dollars for these companies, would you be high-fiving it?
I hope that I have a better moral compass than that.
Well, I know you do, but I'm not sure about
people
them.
People who are trying to maximize the value of their shares that they get as part of their remuneration, they're high-fiving it.
Yeah, they are big time.
Yeah, and when new variants come along, they're high-fiving it. And instead of high-fiving it, maybe they could put a little more effort into vaccinating the third world.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they're saying, thank you, God, thank you, Jesus, for bringing us this virus.
It's kind of unfathomable to go into that darkness, George. I hate to even think about it. But I think that our culture, American and globally, has become so focused on maximizing profit that the culture that develops around that's
right.
shared by people within corporations creates disordered thinking about what our responsibility to society is.
I mean, people within these pharmaceutical companies that are making these billions because of this vaccine some of these guys or women are going to get promoted for this.
Yeah. Let me tell you a story. In the first 15 months of the pandemic, 17 vaccine investors made $50 billion.
Jeez.
In the first 15 months, $50 billion. Well, we got to last May 2021, and the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the World Health Organization got together, and they put an all-hands-on-deck cry out. They said, we need to get vaccines out to the third world. We need Africa to have a 40% vaccination rate by the end of 2021 and a 60 or 70% vaccination rate in 2022. We need that. We're going to lose $9 trillion in economic value globally. People are going to die by the hundreds of thousands, and we need to do this. And how much would it take? $50 billion. The $50 billion that the 17 millionaires had collected in the first 15 months.
And took. Jeez. So where do we head? Where do we go? I mean, with your book sickening, what's the big issue here?
The big issue is that that the pharmaceutical industry, its job is to maximize profits. And to complain about the pharmaceutical industry being greedy is like complaining that zebras have stripes. That's what they do. And we've drifted in the United States towards less government regulation and less guardrails on corporations. But the healthcare industry, and particularly pharma, is particularly uniquely unregulated compared to the other pharmaceutical companies' activities in other countries. We've got to put the guardrails back on this industry so that the benefits, the true fruits of medical science, and they are great. We've got to, you know, we can criticize them, but, you know, they made HIV infection a disease you can live with and have a normal lifespan. Mm-hmm. And there have been wonderful accomplishments from medical science. I don't want to be a Luddite and throw away all of medical science, but I do want to say that it's not going to serve the American people until there are guardrails. And what are those guardrails? Number one, we need health technology assessment. The FDA tells doctors what drugs they can prescribe, but the FDA does nothing, and it's not supposed to do anything, to tell doctors what drugs they should prescribe to benefit their patients most. Other countries have what's called health technology assessment, which is an independent body. It can be governmental, it can be quasi-governmental, it can be non-governmental, but an independent body that gets all the data and that analyzes new drugs in comparison to older drugs and the price of the new drugs to tell physicians and to tell the covering the insurance companies and the payers which drugs are most effective for their patients and which drugs are worth the price that's being charged for their patients. So in the United States, we've got we pay 3.5 times what the other countries pay for their brand name drugs. But we don't have any health technology assessments, so we don't have any mechanism to tell the doctors what the most, what the best treatment is. For example, with insulin in type 2 diabetics, I have a chapter on insulin. Excuse me, it's sickening. One second, I need a drink.
I hope you don't have COVID coming, do you? No.
So we have I have a chapter on insulin, and I show that most of the insulin, about 80% of the insulin in the United States, is used for people with type 2 diabetes. About a quarter of people with type 2 diabetes are eventually going to need insulin.
And that's most of the diabetes cases, right, type 2?
Type 2 is, yeah, it's about 95% of type 2 of diabetes cases. So all type 1s need insulin. I'm not talking about type 1s. I'm talking about type 2s now. And it's the 80% of the type 2s, the type 2s who use 80% of the insulin. So the latest generation of insulin is called insulin analogs. And those drugs have gone up in price. That's what we've heard about, the price gouging. They were going up at 18% per year for a while.
Now metformin, right?
That's where I'm getting to. Metformin costs about $48 a year compared to $5,200. Every diabetic who needs Medicaid, type 2 diabetic, should get into a committed program of exercising and eating a proper diet.
Absolutely.
Many people who have type 2 diabetes or are at risk of it can prevent the diabetes or even turn it around by really committing to healthy lifestyle. So that's step one. Step two is exactly what you said, metformin. It's very effective, very inexpensive, rarely has side effects. But eventually, about a quarter of the people, if they don't change their lifestyle radically, are going to need insulin. So in the United States, about 90% of those people who need insulin with type 2 diabetes get put on insulin analogs. Cost $5,200 a year.
Wow.
The previous generation of bioengineered insulins, which are recombinant human insulin, which cost about $480 a year, are just as effective for type 2 diabetics. But the doctors have been misled to think that the insulin analogs are an innovative breakthrough that lets their diabetics live a more normal life. It's not true. The science doesn't show it. But because we don't have health technology assessment like, say, the UK does or Germany does or Canada, the doctors don't get an impartial analysis of what the benefits of insulin analogs are for type 2 diabetics and what the costs are. So American doctors don't know that we're wasting money. We're wasting about $20 billion a year compared to the countries that have health technology assessment and tell their doctors to start the type 2 diabetics who need insulin on the recombinant human insulin.
John, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John Abramson with us as we talk about Big Pharma. His book is called Sickening. We'll be back.